with this fanciful merger of the of Islam with the Shiite Islam, anyway, and Zoroastrianism through the mythical marriage and offspring and the line of imaginary imams all the way to the 12th imam, which is supposed to be the leader of the Islamic world. Matter of fact, in Iran today, just to show you that this has legs. Remember when Ahmadinejad was president, and he was constantly saying that he was preparing Iran to wipe out Israel because he was the bridge between the world as it exists, with Israel existing as a sore in the midst of the Muslim desire to conquer the world, and the arrival of the 12th Imam. And the 12th Imam is going to be a guy identical to Mr. Ibrahim, who is known as Ibrahim Bakr al-Baghdadi, the head of the Islamic State. He will be a religious cleric first, and then a master of terrorism second. And so they have a religion that is still based upon the legitimacy of a mythical marriage, and that it's these descendants of Ali, the adopted son of Muhammad, through Hussein, who through this lineage that they say is the legitimate heirs to Islam. And thus, that's the Shiite religion. And these line of special imams who are descendants of the prophet, of course, the whole thing's myth. It's strictly a lie. I mean, Islam claims to be a descendant of and to be the religion of Ishmael as well, but there's no connection. But that doesn't change the fact that's what they claim. So that what that did is it made the being a Muslim in Iran equally patriotic to being a Zoroastrian, because of this merger of the two religions through this mythical marriage. And it's still essential to understanding the nature of these of the war between the Sunnis and the Shias, and the grand plans of the Shia. So with Iranian, especially Persian support, the Abbasids overthrew the Umayyads in 750. And for a while, Shia Islam dominated Sunni Islam and the subsequent caliphate and government. It lasted until 1258, although there were lots of factions that broke away before that period of time, where Muslims, Iranians received marked favor in the new government, both in Iran and in the capital in Baghdad. This mitigated the antagonism between Arabs and Iranians, but sharpened the distinction between Muslims and non-Muslims. The Abbasids zealously persecuted all non-Muslims, and particularly now Zoroastrians. They also persecuted any sectarian individual, an atheist or an agnostic. It created a much harsher climate for non-Muslims, Jews, and Zoroastrians. Although the Abbasids were deadly foes of Zoroastrianism, the brand of Islam they promoted throughout Iran became ever more like Zoroastrianism. It incorporated the way that the Iranians and Shiite Islam became popular, and the dominant religion among the Iranians, the Persians, was to Zoroastrianize Shia Islam. It's true to this day. The two decrees in particular that encouraged the transition, however, from a predominantly Zoroastrian society to became overwhelmingly an Islamic society, was the first of these two edicts was that only a Muslim could own Muslim slaves. Thus, a slave that was owned by a Zoroastrian could automatically become a free man just by converting to Islam. And, of course, in the Islamic world, Muslims don't work. It's only through slaves that they have any productivity at all. The other edict that was that had a huge influence, it said that if one male member of a Zoroastrian family converted to Islam, that one individual inherited all of the property of the family. Under Abbasid rule, Muslim Iranians increasingly found ways to taunt the Zoroastrians. Distressing them became a popular sport, just as they are, the Sunni Muslims now are taunting them today. It was a sport that goes back 1,300 years. Now, there's one of these proclivities that we see in Afghanistan and we saw in Iraq, which caused great distress among American troops. And that is Muhammad hated dogs. But Zoroastrians love dogs. Zoroastrians saw dogs as, because of their loyalty, their allegiance to their family, they're willing to actively engage on behalf of their family. The Zoroastrians saw dogs as a symbol of the progressive force. But Muhammad saw dogs as symbols of the devil. And so Muslims routinely torture dogs. It's a death cult, Islam is, and they routinely torture dogs. And so one of the popular means to distress Zoroastrianism was to maltreat dogs, an animal sacred to Zoroastrians. Such baiting, which was to continue down through the centuries and continues today in Afghanistan, torturing dogs is considered sport. The high officials in particular encouraged the population to do this just to torment the Zoroastrians. Yazd became the seat of the Iranian high priest during the Mongol rule, when the best hope for survival for a non-Muslim was to be completely inconspicuous. Crucial to the present-day survival of Zoroastrianism was the migration from northern and northeastern Iran to Sanjan in southwestern Khorasan. Zoroastrianism is often compared with Manichaeism. Manichaeism is the actual basis of Gnosticism, and it has its roots in the Iranian Persian religion that then was adopted by Hellenistic philosophers, starting with Plato. And Manichaeism, Gnosticism, which has many similarities with Zoroastrianism, is evident throughout Pauline Christianity, particularly in Galatians and Romans, where Paul is constantly equating the Torah with the flesh, which is evil, which is bad, which is enslaving, and his gospel of grace with the Spirit, which is uplifting, which is new, which is positive. That's the essence of Manichaeism, Zoroastrianism, Gnosticism, and to a large degree Christianity. Faith is good. The law is bad. And so this dualistic approach was adopted by many of the Yazatas, which define the people that America is now trying to save. Manichaeism and Zoroastrianism see the spiritual world as different from the natural one, and thus the word paradise, which is from a Zoroastrian term, paradaza, applies equally to both religion, as it does to Islam as well. It's a borrowed word into Islam. The Manichaeism's basic doctrine was that the world and all of the corporal bodies were constructed from the substance of Satan. This is Paul's idea, too, that the flesh is of Satan. And this is an idea that while it's at odds with with Zoroastrianism, which just has two opposing forces. It set in motion the basis of much of Islam and Christianity. And it's a corruption that is troubling, even today. From what may be inferred by the Manichaean texts and a few Zoroastrian sources, the adherents of the two religions, which had enormous similarities, despised one another, just as there are enormous similarities between Shia and Sunni Muslims. You know, they have a 95% overlap in terms of the nature of the religion, and yet they despise each other. Same thing was true here with Gnosticism, if you will, and Zoroastrianism. As for Zoroaster himself, he's said to be born in northeast Iran, maybe in southwest Afghanistan. He's a Bronze Age character, emerging from a polytheistic religious culture, which included particularly the use of intoxicants, which we see very popular in Iran today and, of course, in Afghanistan. The religion is quite similar to the early forms of Hinduism in India. The name Zoroaster is a Greek rendering of the name of Zarathustra. He was known as Zartost in Persian. Zoroaster's birth and early life are, well, to say sparsely documented would be too generous. What is known, if you want to put known in parentheses, is recorded in the Gathas, the core of the Asvesta, which is the scriptures of Zoroastrianism, which contains the hymns that are thought to have been composed by this perhaps mythical individual, Zoroaster. Born into a priestly clan, he ended up marrying, had a number of kids, according to the mythological lore. But he rejected the religion of the Bronze Age Iranians, the Persians, with their many gods and oppressive class structure. And so he created a religion that had less class structure, that enlightened people that were, it's kind of like communism and secular humanism, where the enlightened are empowered as opposed to those who are born into the higher classes. So it gives rise to socialist secular humanism. It's very similar to the religious thought of one Adam Weishaupt and the Order of the Illumes. But folks, this is important. The legend of Zoroaster has him rejecting the religion of the Hindus and the Persians that was being practiced all around him, just like Muhammad, just like Adam Weishaupt, just like Paul. He is said that he was opposed to their many gods, just like Muhammad, just like Adam Weishaupt and the Illuminists. And so what his solution was to promote one of the pagan gods and call that god the god. Very much like Paul elevating Dionysus to be the model for his Jesus. Exactly like Muhammad choosing Allah out of a rock pile of gods and goddesses. He did exactly the same thing with his god. And then he said, you know, we have to get rid of the oppressive class structure. And the reason was that he wanted those enlightened with his philosophy to be empowered, as opposed to those who were born into power, either through the priesthood or through kingship, royalty. It's exactly what Adam Weishaupt sought to do, to undermine the integration between cleric and king in Roman Catholic-controlled Europe. This is, Satan is a one-trick pony. This is how he rules. And what you're seeing here is the basis for socialist secular humanism, the basis of Islam, the basis of Pauline Christianity, all growing out of this same myth. It's a religion where ordinary people, that had adopted the enlightenment of Zoroaster would control the masses. Communism today. Now, he was opposed to the use of hallucinogenic plant rituals. But, maybe hallucinating, he held up the rooster as the symbol of light and associated the cock with good against evil. I'm sure there's a Freudian line there somehow, but I'm not going to go there. His rulings on status and rank and protocol were all interpreted through the nature of the cock. That's a male rooster, folks. In Zoroastrianism, good transpires for those who do religious deeds, the Jedi Academy. Those who do evil have themselves to blame for their ruin, the dark side of the Force. Zoroastrian morality is then summed up by the simple phrase, good thoughts, good words, good deeds. So, Scott, that's the answer to your question. You want to know who America is saving? They wouldn't go in to save Christians, mind you. They wouldn't go in to save Jews, mind you. But they will go in to save Zoroastrians from a conflict that has been eradicating them and annihilating them for 1,400 years. It's a lot like putting your finger in a glass of water and removing it and expecting the water in that glass to be somehow different.
Yeah, good answer. I now know who they are, and I have the same question. I mean, it's back to the same thing. What's the best possible scenario that we can have in this whole thing?
Arming the Kurds, yeah. By now airlifting the Zoroastrians off the hilltop, by bombing American weapons with American weapons to hold the Islamic State at bay, the best we could possibly hope is that somebody in Washington gets a brain, and we get a heart and some character, and that we recognize that there is no positive outcome, that we broke this country, that our invasion was based on lies, that our actions were counterproductive, and that we are deeply sorry for the hell that we have unleashed on this country. But that more action by the United States would simply make what we have already caused to be even worse. And that we stop supplying weapons that lead to more and more carnage, and we disengage completely. And that our rhetoric, as it relates to the country that we broke, would change from integration to isolation. That the only hope for Iraq and Syria is to be broken up just as Yugoslavia was sliced into pieces, with every ethnic group and every religious affinity having their own little slice of their paradisia. That's the only hope for this region. The answer I gave to Scott's question was, is there anything we can do? Was an answer that, of course, leads to no, there's nothing we will do. Because what America has to do is to do what I did many years ago. And that's admit that I was wrong. I was wrong about being patriotic. I was wrong about being a flag-waving, pro-military citizen. I was wrong about being active in the Republican Party. I was wrong about being an ordained minister and evangelist in the Presbyterian Church. I was wrong about leading Bible studies from Paul's letters. I was wrong in assuming that there was a renewed covenant and therefore a New Testament. I was wrong. I was wrong in thinking there was a Jesus Christ. I was wrong in celebrating Christmas and Easter. Admitting that you're wrong, particularly when it opens you up to the truth, coming to know in this case Yahweh, coming to observe his Torah, coming to engage in his covenant and be adopted into his family, when abandoning lies opens you up to knowing the truth, it is the most liberating thing, the most empowering thing, the most enriching thing you can do in your life. So admitting that you're wrong is not humiliating. It's uplifting. It's what America needs to do. America needs to admit that what it did in Iraq was wrong, that it was counterproductive, that by engaging militarily, by arming both sides, we not only broke that country, we gave the country to Iran, we created the imbalance of power between Sunni and Shia Muslims that led to the civil war in Syria, which we again supplied arms directly to the Mujahideen and indirectly through Qatar, that were then used to cross the border and further break apart this country that we had invaded, Iraq. Everything we did was wrong. And so the answer is to admit we were wrong. The strategy of invading was wrong. The strategy of providing weapons was wrong. The strategy of unification of groups that have hated each other and have oppressed one another for 1,400 years was wrong. And speaking of wrong, think about this for a moment. The United States is threatening Russia for wanting to supply a convoy of trucks loaded with food, with water, and with medicines, from saving the community of Donetsk that is being bombarded militarily by the Kiev regime. We say, no, you can't do that. And yet the United States is airlifting food while bombing the Islamic State on behalf of Zoroastrians who have no affinity whatsoever to America. And Russia is doing this on behalf of Russian citizens and ethnic Russians. I mean, just think of the hypocrisy in us doing what we're doing and not even allowing the Russians to do any, even approximate what we're doing. And putting sanctions on them while calling ourselves noble for this great humanitarian effort. We've lost it. Now, Scott asked, he says, you know, I was born, what was your date 1980 or 1985 in that period of time?
1980.
Has America used its military to do anything that was beneficial? Well, it certainly hasn't stopped any invasions, but it certainly hasn't made America safe and free.
And the question was, in my lifetime, have they done anything?
Yeah. And in your lifetime, really all you have is Afghanistan and Iraq. As well as bombing Libya. Well, we made a mess of Libya. We made a mess of Afghanistan. We made a mess of Iraq. So the answer would be no, no, and no. Every use of the U.S. military has been counterproductive. Now, if you want to go back a little further, in Vietnam, our invasion of Vietnam was counterproductive. We made a bad situation worse at the cost of millions of lives. You want to go back even further and you deal with Korea. In Korea, we ended up getting slaughtered by the very Red Chinese that we emboldened during the Second World War. Now, you want to go back a little further and you deal with World War II and you say, oh, but our military won great victories against awful enemies. No, we left Europe worse than we found it. Not many Americans have had the opportunity to do what I've done. I'm grateful for this exposure. I spent a considerable amount of time traveling throughout Russia. I went down into the stands, you know, the parts of the Russian Federation that aren't even part of Russia anymore. Uzbekistan, for example. I went as far as Mongolia, traveled all through Siberia. But, of course, all of the area around the Ukraine, and Moscow, and what was then Leningrad. I saw what communism did to a people. I saw communism as a religion, where the statues and billboards were all men deified as they had been in Rome, with their statements being recorded as if they were scripture. I saw what propaganda does to a people. But it didn't stop there. I spent considerable time in all of the Iron Curtain countries. Saw what it was like to live in East Germany under the Stalinists. Saw what it was like to live in Hungary and Romania, for example, under communist rule. And I've been back to those countries since they have been liberated. And the common thread by all of the people, if you speak as an individual who says, you know, I know that I'm an American and you're going to judge me negatively because I'm an American and view me as ignorant. But I was in the Soviet Union. I was here when your country, Lithuania, for example, was controlled by the Soviets. And I've been back now that you've been liberated from them. And they will all say, without exception, that America's partnership with Stalin that enabled the Soviets to control their countries after that war was far worse than their exposure to the Nazis. Now, there were some countries like Poland where the conditions under the Nazis were worse than they were under the communists, although both were hellish. But for the most part, every one of those countries will tell you that we left Europe worse than we found it. And if you move across the pond to the Japanese theater, the only reason that that the Japanese invaded the Philippines is because Americans were there. It was an American base. We owned the Philippines. We were an imperial power because of the Spanish-American War. And it was attacked just to keep America from using it as a launching base to attack Japan. Had we not been there, they would have had no reason to be there. The Japanese wanted two things, access to steel and access to oil. Now, I will tell you that certainly that their invasion of China was horrific. Their invasion of Korea was horrific. Now, we didn't liberate either China or Korea, although we destroyed Imperial Japan. But I'm here to tell you that a little country like Japan would never have been able to occupy and control a huge country like China for any length of time. Within 20 years, it would have been over without the loss of so many American lives, without the loss of so many Japanese lives. And by empowering Mao Zedong over Chiang Kai-shek in China as part of our war strategy, we left much of the world much worse than we found it. Mao Zedong starved 40 million Chinese to death. The communist rise in that part of the region was a direct result of particularly Eisenhower's and the Secretary of State at that time, Dulles, their maneuverings in that part of the world with their socialist ideology. We made a mess. You know, you can't claim that America's military was used for good in the Spanish-American War, in the Mexican-American War, in the Civil War, and most certainly not in the American-Indian Wars. Us breaking Iraq, us breaking Afghanistan, us making a bad situation worse in those countries, just like we did in Vietnam, and not learning a lesson, is an ongoing broken record. And the only way to break this ongoing record of malfeasance is for America to grow a conscience, for Americans to shed their ignorance, and for us to begin by saying, we were wrong. And then diminish the size of our military so we don't continue to invade countries and break them. So we don't go and bomb countries like we did Libya and creating a living hellhole there. So we don't weaponize what was a peaceful protest in Syria and turn it into a bloodthirsty civil war, of which the largest cities in Syria have been utterly destroyed. Heaps of ruins. Because of our behavior. We need to stop being the arms merchants of the world. We need to stop giving our lip service as if we were moral while we're undermining whole societies as we did in the Ukraine. We need to begin with a complete change. You know, when you read the prophets, particularly Yeshayah and Yirmiyah, but more Yeshayah than any other, this is what you hear over and over again. Yahweh telling his people, you need to change. What you're doing is reckless. What you're doing is rebellious. What you're doing is counterproductive. You need to see yourselves for who you are. You need to admit that you're wrong. You need to change. You need to let go of all of the things that you hold dear and to recognize you were wrong. Because only when you do that are you in a position to embrace the truth. And it's the truth that liberates. It's the truth that empowers. We'll be back in a moment. Remember yesterday or the day before when we were talking about the Islamic State, and I said, you know, something really strange has happened quietly. That there's no mention anymore of al-Nusra, which was the dominant fundamentalist Islamic Mujahideen force in Syria. Al-Nusra was, I mean, overwhelmingly larger than was the Islamic State. Now, we don't know that absolutely for certain because al-Nusra was fighting in Homs, and it was fighting in Aleppo, and it was fighting in the western part of Syria where there was more news coverage, and the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria was making their gains throughout all of that vast swaths of desert in eastern Syria where the refineries are, where the towns are, and so they didn't interact very much. But then there was a period of time where they began to fight each other. Well, things have changed. There's now a news story. It's out of Aleppo. And everything that you hear is conflicting here. So as I share this news story with you, be braced for conflict. So it says Syrian rebels, and it doesn't say who those Syrian rebels are, would suffer their biggest setback of the war as government troops and Islamic militants, and the Islamic militants they're talking about now is the Islamic State, are encircling the key northwestern city of Aleppo. Aleppo, by the way, going back 5 years ago, is the largest city in Damascus. Millions of people, I think like 3 million people lived in Aleppo. The number now is reduced by 90%. So the Wall Street Journal is reporting that the fall of the city could also be seen as a recruiting boon to the Islamic State. The militant group, formerly known as ISIS, with the members of the Western-backed Free Syrian Army joining with the militants. So you've got now the Islamic State and Hezbollah and the Syrian army, all surrounding Aleppo, which is essentially a sea of ruins. I don't know if you've looked at pictures of Homs and Aleppo, but if you have, it's the most devastating thing I've ever seen. It's worse than the devastation at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You know, in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, with the exception of a couple of buildings, just everything was flattened. But in Homs and Aleppo, that's not the way it is. The top one-third of virtually every building has crumbled off. And the exterior walls of most buildings have fallen into the street. And so what you see is these ghostly, contorted ruins. Streets that are 6 and 8 feet high with rubble. And 4 and 5 story buildings that have been clipped and that have jagged edges and external walls exposed and no one living there. few people, you know, walking down the streets over the rubble. I mean, it's literally as worse than anything you would see in one of Dante's Inferno's depictions of hell. And so now with these pieces, there's this myth that the Free Syrian Army is in Aleppo trying to hold them off. But at the same time, we're being told that that what little there was of the Free Syrian Army, which were still fundamentalist Muslims, that they're now joining the Islamic State. And we hear nothing of al-Nusra, as if they were now just part of the Islamic State, because they were the primary operatives in this part of the country. Rebel commanders in Aleppo told the journal that they are stockpiling food and other supplies to prevent the type of starvation-inducing siege that forced them to surrender the city of Homs earlier this year, and warned that losing Aleppo, and this is not a siege being perpetrated now by the Islamic State as they are with the Zoroastrians. This is a siege being perpetrated by Hezbollah, the Iranian Mujahideen, and the army of Assad. And then it says that if they were to surrender Aleppo, that it would be a death blow to the revolt against Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Now, that's unbelievably stupid. But, of course, this is one group of militants telling this to the Post because they want more American weapons. But, in fact, if that group of militants does what they appear to be doing and simply joining the Islamic State, what it makes is the inevitable fate of Damascus sealed. That the Sunnis, by their sheer numbers, by their success, by their weapons, will prevail.